Welcome to The Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby from Bennington, Vermont. 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show, we'll explore controversies over natural resources. Salmon fishermen in the Northwest are suing loggers to protect the fish and their jobs. The timber industry points to other causes of the salmon decline. Then salmon fishermen will lock horns with the timber industry over what should be done. Then we'll look at life off the electric grid. We'll meet people who don't worry about natural resources because they use sunlight. These stories and more coming up this week on The Environment Show. A decade ago, a small owl living in the ancient forest of the Pacific Northwest touched off a major controversy. Politicians and economists, environmentalists and business people, and folk who know the woods, whether they be loggers or hikers, all came invested in the spotted owl. To protect the owl from extinction, federal courts ordered a reluctant U.S. Forest Service to halt logging on large tracts of ancient forests until a valid plan could be developed which would protect the owl. The timber industry frequently characterized the dispute as one of jobs versus owls. A new lawsuit has been brought, this one to prevent logging in roadless and ancient forest areas east of the Cascade Mountains in Oregon and Washington. Instead of being about jobs and owls, this suit is about jobs and jobs. Salmon fishermen contend that unless the trees are protected, the streams where salmon spawn will become polluted with silt, and without shade, water temperature will rise, ruining the habitat salmon need to lay their eggs. Glenn Spain is the Northwest Regional Director of the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Association. He says there are more jobs in catching and processing salmon than in harvesting wood.
The fundamental issues here are just as important, if not more important, than in the spotted owl litigation. The salmon is the keystone of this. It's the basis of a major industry that supports tens of thousands of family wage jobs. So this isn't a jobs versus environment issue. This is a jobs versus jobs issue. This is an industry versus industry issue. And ultimately, the decision will be, do we trade off our future for a handful of silver coins today?
Spain adds that salmon play a huge role in the economy of the region, and that because they come from forests, the trees are more valuable standing than in the sawmill.
Salmon is the number two forest-dependent industry in this region, contributing well over $1.25 billion in the past years to the economy of this region. Salmon come from forests. Salmon come from those old-growth forests. That's where they spawn. That's where they're reared, and that's where they grow to a size which allows them to survive on their long journey through the sea. And that's where they come back to spawn. Without those forests, you devastate the salmon at the very roots of their life cycle.
But the timber companies point to other threats to salmon. Doug Butels is the communications manager of the Boise Cascade Company, one of the largest forest products firms in the Pacific Northwest. He argues that concentration by the fishermen on forest habitat is misplaced, and that the real threat to salmon comes from power dams, fishing, and other downstream conditions.
Scientists caution not to look at any single factor solution to the problem. There are a variety of reasons for the decline of salmon populations. Degradation of stream habitat is a minor one of those. The other thing that we need to keep in mind is thinking about salmon recovery is to think about downstream causes more than habitat, because factors such as the hydroelectric system, commercial fishing, loss of estuary habitat, just a number of things have all contributed to the decline of the salmon, and they all need to be looked at together.
But others feel that both habitat loss in the forests and downstream conditions take their toll on salmon, whose life cycle takes them from gravel beds in the wooded streams to the ocean and back. Ernie Niemi is an economist at the firm of ECO Northwest in Eugene, Oregon. He feels that the impact on salmon of the power dams and the loss of habitat in spawning areas is about the same.
There's increasing evidence indicating that the habitat degradation, the magnitude of that impact on the fishery is roughly comparable to the impact of the dams. That is to say, you get fewer adults returning back to the headwaters, and they find that the habitat is so degraded that even those that get back are not as successful in reproducing.
Everybody agrees that the economy in the Northwest is undergoing tremendous change. And despite the fact that there is less logging and fewer salmon, there has been substantial economic growth. Some feel that the growth, which has been spurred by neither the cutting of logs or the catching of salmon, is dependent on the trees remaining in the forests and the fish in the rivers. In short, the best future may lie in leaving our remaining natural resources of the Northwest where they are and ensuring that the overall environment is better protected.
If you look at the Pacific Northwest as a whole, you see that it has enjoyed very robust economic growth, an increase in jobs and an increase in incomes over the last decade, just as the timber industry has contracted by, you know, one-fourth or more. The reason that the economy in this region is growing is because you have the intersection of two forces. People are very mobile and are choosing to live where they can find a quality of life that they like. And for many people, they find that quality of life in the Pacific Northwest. In addition, you have industries that are increasingly footloose. They can locate wherever they want to, and so they locate where they can find a very good labor force and where they can find a very good market. The intersection of those two forces in the Pacific Northwest means that we have a robust economy precisely because we have a very good environment in which people want to live.
Ernie Niemi is an economist with ECO Northwest in Eugene, Oregon. We're joined by Chuck Burley, who I must point out is not a relation, who is the Eastern Oregon Manager of the Northwest Forestry Association, located in Bend, Oregon, and Glenn Spain, who is the Northwest Regional Director of the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations, locking horns over the question, should logging in ancient forests and roadless areas east of the Cascade Mountains be stopped to protect salmon populations? Mr. Burley?
Absolutely not, Peter. The problem with salmon is not with land management activities. There exists quality spawning habitat that is not being utilized. The reason is not enough salmon are returning to spawn. This is due to downstream factors including direct and incidental harvest of salmon, passage around dams, and poor ocean conditions. This does not mean that we can ignore the impacts land management activities might have on riparian and aquatic habitats. And in the past several years, both federal and state regulations of timber harvesting have been strengthened to improve the protection of these resources. Much of the scientific community believes that these protection measures are adequate. In addition, scientists agree that the worst we could do with the east side forest is not manage them because of the poor forest health conditions and risk of catastrophic wildfire. Our recent failure to manage the fuel loads and vegetative composition of Eastside forests, including old-growth forests, have put salmon and other fisheries at far greater risk today than they have been at any time in the past, including the peak logging periods of the early 80s.
Mr. Spain, in reply.
Well, I obviously don't take the same position. We have a lot of impacts on salmon, but one of those impacts is forestry. And we're talking about very fragile riparian areas and spawning and key rearing habitat areas in the last remaining old-growth forest, which is what those salmon need for their survival. I don't think there's any justification in the science, and I think there are a number of scientists who would disagree with Mr. Burley that, number one, we have to manage those forests in order to save them. I don't think cutting down the forests in order to save them is necessarily a viable alternative. And furthermore, I think many scientists would agree that the main problems with logging are siltation in those spawning areas, and that if you do that, even in fire areas, you can often make the situation worse. So, yes, there are hydropower impacts. Yes, there are harvest impacts, though I'd point out that the fishing industry, unlike the timber industry, is managed, federally managed, under the basis of sustainability. But all these impacts are beside the point if there aren't enough salmon coming out of those forests to
Chuck
supply
Burley,
the harvest.
30 seconds.
Well, the whole issue of timber management and, as Mr. Spain pointed out, sustainability is a non-issue, for instance, on the Wallowa-Whitman National Forest in northeast Oregon, which is host to much of this salmon habitat. In the late 1970s, they were harvesting over 200 million board feet a year, and last year, 1995, that's been reduced nearly 85% to only 30 million board feet. So the type of activities and the level of activities that Mr. Spain is referring to simply are not occurring today as they used to in the past, and they are being regulated much more stringently than they have to prevent the types of problems, as Mr. Spain alluded to, such as siltation.
Mr. Spain, the last word.
Well, one of the problems is that the process to look at these has been unplugged by Congress. Congress is in the process of defunding the management planning for that region. Our suit basically is saying until there is a scientifically credible management plan, we ought not to irrevocably destroy the resource in ways that we don't know what the implications will ultimately be.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Well, thank you, Peter.
Thank you.
The Environment Show welcomes your comments. You can write us at P.O. Box 66600, Albany, New York, 12206 6600. Or you can email us at envshow@aol.com. Still ahead, we'll explore life off the grid. Houses, cities, and even the military are turning to sustainable energy sources that don't need any power lines. And we'll consider how use of a common resource, in this case pasture for sheep and goats, is a key element in achieving peace on the west bank of the Jordan River. These stories, plus our Earth calendar, still ahead on the Environment Show. In the U.S., almost every building has electricity. Nearly all are connected to the grid. That means wires leading to power plants which burn fuel and cause pollution. But there are some places where hooking into the grid is difficult. There are also some pioneering people who choose to produce their own energy and not contribute to the pollution which surrounds us all. Thomas Lally reports on life off the grid.
When Dottie and Dennis Simmons moved to the town of Bridgeville in 1977, they found the perfect site for their home in the hills of Northern California. But there was one drawback. The site was so far from power lines it would be a major expense just to bring electricity to the house. Undaunted, the Simmons went ahead and bought the property. Dottie Simmons says when faced with paying the local utility for power lines or forging out on their own, the choice was obvious.
The system we have set up now is still a couple thousand dollars less expensive than it would have been to have the power company run the lines down here, and then they would have charged us every month. We set this all up for less than the cost of hooking in, and we've never had to pay on it, because there's no bill once you've got it.
Today, electricity for the Simmons home comes from three sources: solar power from photovoltaic panels, hydro from a small wheel set in a nearby creek, and propane to run the refrigerator. The system not only serves the Simmons house, it also supplies all the power needed for their mail order soap business.
Our business, we have a certain amount of machinery. We have two computers, we have kettles for stirring soaps and things like that in the house. You know, we don't have a microwave, but I don't want a microwave, but we have a VCR, stereos, blenders.
And the Simmons aren't alone. In California, there are an estimated 20,000 homes producing their own electricity. Two utilities are even getting into the act. Sacramento Municipal Utility District and Southern California Edison sell photovoltaics to their customers. But California is not the only place where people are jumping off the grid. Jeffrey Fowler lives in Worthington, Massachusetts, and like the Simmons, he left the grid in the 70s. He says he was motivated as a Yankee individualist to become independent. We reached him as he was repairing his roof.
He's coming down. He's up on the, straddling the peak of the roof, which is a good 60 feet above the ground. Here he comes.
Okay. Hello?
Hello, Mr. Fowler. How did you get off the grid?
I grew up in Worthington, and I moved to the other side of Worthington because I wanted to build a passive solar house in 1981. When I did that, the only piece of land that I found that did not have any power line to it, but it was perfect southern exposure. So I built a house and decided I would power it later. And with that, the house system just kept expanding, and at this point, it runs everything much like a normal house.
Do you ever worry about not being on the grid, or you know, do you ever experience outages because of a failure of the equipment?
It's actually the opposite. Is whenever there's an outage, people are complaining about the outage, and we don't have it.
In fact, Fowler's experience off the grid was so successful, he wrote a book called The Evolution of an Independent Home, the story of a solar electric pioneer. Fowler says his home in the mountains of New England is so energy efficient that even when it's below zero outside, his home is more than adequately heated by just the sun. But homes are only one area of life off the grid. Industry and government is also taking a look at sustainable energy. For instance, many of us may not even notice the solar-powered sign on many of our highways. Today, even the military and companies with remote locations power some of their operations with solar power. In the town of Carrollton, Texas, many electric signs are solar-powered. Richard Gurley, manager for traffic operations for Carrollton, says solar signs have saved the town money and headaches.
Well, we have several different types of solar-powered equipment now. We have school flashers. All the school flashers in Carrollton are solar-powered, and there's about 75 of those units around town. And we've just purchased a changeable message sign that's solar-powered, and that's, you know, those changeable message signs like you see out on the interstate telling you that lanes are closed ahead or those type of things, road construction ahead.
If you didn't have the solar-powered signs, what would you have to do?
Well, you would have to find a power source with the power company, and you may have to go three or four blocks and under a lot of driveways, through a lot of people's yards, sprinkler systems to get to that source of power, which is very expensive in a lot of cases.
Similar solar signs are in operation across the country, and as solar and other alternative energy technologies get cheaper and more efficient, you might be the next one to jump off the grid. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
Since the days of Abraham, farmers and ranchers in the Mideast have been fighting over land and water. It remains to be seen whether tensions will ease with the recent peace accords. However, Peter Haggerty, an entrepreneur from North America, believes that he has what it takes to bring peace and prosperity to the dry and largely unsettled rangeland around the west bank of the Jordan River. He believes that a sustainable peace depends on sustainable pasture and healthy sheep. Bruce Robertson has more on Project Peace Fleece.
It is a long way from Keyser Falls, Maine, to the west bank of the Jordan River. But Peter Haggerty believes he just may have found a connection that will bring peace to the Mideast, where kings and prime ministers, presidents and high-level diplomats, even pharaohs and prophets, have failed for thousands of years. Several years ago, Haggerty hit upon an idea he now calls Peace Fleece.
We were convinced that Palestinians and Israelis could cooperate together if they were placed in an economic setting where they mutually had to depend on one another for their daily bread, so to speak. The face of people we work with every day have a lot to do with the fact that their country is at war with each other. And that obviously not only affects the quality of their lives, but the lives of their livestock that they depend on for their existence. And the livestock, the problems with livestock involve finding adequate grazing land as well as quality drinking water. And we see that as a business because the people we work with and their families are more productive when they're healthy. And so it definitely benefits us as a company, not only spiritually but also economically, to make sure that that these families that we work with are healthy.
How is animal health related to the water use of water and the grazing rights?
Animal health is, of course, greatly affected by the nutrition and also by disease. And the interesting thing about disease is that disease doesn't respect any political boundaries like the Green Line. Disease like anthrax, hoof and mouth disease, brucellosis, disease that not only impacts animals but also human beings, wanders freely back and forth across the political boundary that we see between Israel and the West Bank. And what's tragic is when people on both sides can't cooperatively work together to eradicate the disease. And even though there have been efforts in the past, I certainly don't mean to imply that ours is the first. Ours might be the first time that Israeli veterinarians and Palestinian veterinarians publicly at this point in time are willing to get together and say, look, in spite of where we're going, but most importantly, because of where we're going in the peace process, it's now time to come out and say we've got to stop this disease, and we can do it by, you know, getting together in this kind of setting.
And says Haggerty, in so doing, the dialogue is more easily moved from shared issues of animal health to shared issues of natural resources, for neither the water nor the rangeland respect human political boundaries. Peter Haggerty, his project called Peace Fleece, is working with sheep farmers near the West Bank village of Neve Shalom, Wahad al-Salam. This is Bruce Robertson.
And now it's time for our Earth calendar. This month, the last of the North American Swainson's hawks should be arriving in Argentina for the winter. These birds are unusual predators because they flock in tremendous numbers. Keith Bilstein is the director of research at Hawk Mountain in Kempton, Pennsylvania. He says as many as 4,000 hawks may migrate together at one time.
We're talking about a species that flocks not only when it's feeding and when it's roosting, but also on migration, has relatively narrow migration corridor, which passes through eastern Mexico and down through the isthmus of Panama. And in late September, early October, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of birds representing almost the entire population of Swainson's hawk passing single sites over the course of a 2 or 3 week period.
But while these birds are known to migrate in large numbers, their overall population is down, perhaps by as much as 90%. Bilstein says this is undoubtedly due to the loss of habitat in the U.S., but the real culprit is what happens to the hawks when they reach Argentina.
The practices that are underway in Argentina now are targeting large swarming insects, locusts, grasshoppers, and the like. These are the same insects that that Swainson's hawks, large flocks of Swainson's hawks, target as prey.
In one documented case, as many as 700 Swainson's hawks were killed at one time from pesticide poisoning. Many but not all of the pesticides dangerous to the hawks are banned in the U.S. But while Argentina may be thousands of miles away, the actions there affect life in our own Midwest. The flight of the Swainson's hawk reminds us once again that the effects of poisons are not confined by political boundaries. Thanks for joining us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 302. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Chartog is the executive producer. The Environment Show is made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby, 1-800-CARHERE. So long. Join us again next week for The Environment Show.